Okay. One of the most interesting stories we've heard in quite a long time, it's a story being presented by Doug and Bertie Lockhart. It has to do with souls who were in mental asylum, I guess I should say plural, right after the Civil War, late 1800s. Many who were never given proper acknowledgement as living human beings. When they died, they got a monument on the graveyard that was just a number or numbers. That was it. And Doug and Bertie have been chosen somehow to receive information, messages, both in automatic writing and certainly in the mind of people who were in the institution in question near their home in their area. And they have been working very, very hard to actually pay for and erect stone monuments for many of the, I hate to say inmates, but patients at the hospital who died while they were in the hospital. And many of those, of course, were Civil War veterans. And there's another angle to that. I think many of you have seen this, the images from last time by now, hopefully. And if you go right now to guests, let's make sure that everything works on my end, and click on tonight's guest, you'll see Doug and Bertie, Souls of the Asylum, Part 3. And you'll see gallery under that. We'll get to the pictures here in a few minutes, but they are there, and they're very interesting. We'll do some handwriting analysis, so to speak, and there have been professionals who have looked at these writing samples. It is quite remarkable. So let's find out what they have to say in our part three tonight about getting these souls properly acknowledged so they can move on. Many of them are apparently hanging around here because they feel abused, forgotten, dishonored, and that's not a good thing, either when you're alive or after. They're still here. And this is helping all of them move on. When they get proper recognition, proper acknowledgement, they are liberated and they can go into the light. And wherever that takes them has got to be better than where they are now. All right, let's say hello to Doug. Are you there? Can you hear me all right, Doug? How are you feeling?
Hello, Jeff. Yes, I'm feeling much better, thanks.
Good, good. And Bertie?
Well, good evening. I am also here. I'm feeling a lot better also. Thank you very much.
You're not going to cough or sneeze for us? Nothing?
I'm going to certainly try not to. I still have congestion, believe it or not. But
no, I do believe it.
The good, right medicines, it's funny how quickly you can heal.
Did you get, you did write to me, and I think you said you've started on that course?
Yes. Of course, that's the only thing that really works.
That is the only thing that really works. We're talking about ivermectin, for those of you who can't put the dots together on this one. But it is. I have another good friend, very, very valuable colleague and friend of this program, and he got sick, and I think he got shed upon or tagged somehow, and I think he had COVID. I'm not sure, but everything fits. And he got ivermectin, and literally after one tablet, he was so much better, he was shocked. So, and we've seen stories like this many times. So, good. Glad you were able to get going.
I am also one of those stories. I had pneumonia. I was about to go to the hospital, and a friend called and said, take this. Within 3 hours, I was able to wake up and go, what happened? Yep.
Wow, there you go. Now,
yep.
I'm so glad you didn't go to the hospital because, unfortunately,
me too.
They do the wrong things. Yeah,
that was in the very beginning, you know, mm-hmm. And I wasn't going to go to the hospital, but Doug was, you know, pretty scared because I had, my blood pressure was high, my temperature was up, my pneumonia set in within half an hour, and I just thought, what happened, you know? So, then once I took that, within 3 hours, it was like I was a totally different person.
I've had stories of people who have loved ones in the hospital with similar circumstances, and they sneak it in there and give them a tablet. And by the next day, they're well enough, and they're discharged.
Yeah.
It's happened.
Or is that too?
So,
yep.
You know, I would urge all of you to think about ivermectin. Have it on hand. Go ahead, Doug.
Another side note is all of this is very connected. I just think as I'm getting older, the older I get, the less I really understand or know. I think, and it is frustrating because it seems like a lot of what I was taught when I was younger was false or not the whole truth.
And it's worse now.
It is worse now. And so we're talking about our bodies and our health or our diet and the food pyramid and how that's upside down. But we're also talking about the whole spiritual realm. What happens when you die? What happens to the people, around us? And why is this all happening? And all of these, we're getting little bits. And I just encourage everybody to just always think for themselves, look for the answer that resonates with you and do your research and just don't take another person's word for it, for sure.
Yeah. No, and if you ever do have to go into a hospital, make darn sure you have an advocate for you, and in writing, put it on your chart. Remdesivir. R-E-M-D-E-S-I-V-I-R. Remdesivir. Spell it any way you want. That'll kill you. It has killed millions of people.
One doctor renamed that run, death is near.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, no argument here.
Yep.
I killed a friend of mine. They killed him in Florida.
I'm sorry.
And I told him, I said, don't let them, tell the doctor. And he did. He told them, no remdesivir. He told them.
Yep.
And he got worse. Every day he got worse. And I talked to him. He got worse again. I said, well, what's going on? Are you sure they didn't give you remdesivir? He said, well, my lungs are filling up with fluid. And I said, get your chart. Read your chart. And he did. And it showed that they had given him remdesivir against his instructions. He called the doctor in and said, why did you do this? And the doctor laughed and said, don't worry. I just gave you enough to save your life. He was dead within a week.
Oh, my goodness.
That's what the doctor said. That guy should... he should be given remdesivir and tied down and let him enjoy it. These people are evil, many of them. Evil as it gets. Okay.
Yeah.
Where are we? Where would you like to start with our story here? This is a very, very interesting story. Let me just preface this by saying that when Doug was a kid, he was not a model student. All right? He didn't learn how to write in cursive style. He printed. He didn't learn a lot of things in school. He didn't like school. And understandable. Doesn't mean he's not smart. Just he didn't like the discipline or whatever it was. And I do understand how kids sometimes are absolutely brilliant. They want nothing to do with school and they get Fs. I got an F, one F in high school. I got an F in French. I got an F in algebra too. I beg your pardon. I got two Fs in high school. I hated algebra and I hated French. I still don't like French. Anyway. Yeah. All right. So where are we? Doug, why don't you start this off?
Doug and I are kind of opposite in that. I loved school. I loved to learn. I loved languages. I love French, by the way. but I loved math. Math was probably my favorite. I love reading. And we're just very opposite on a lot of aspects. But so we balance each other very well. We do.
I tell this story of my past, and it's not that I'm ashamed or anything. I tell it because it makes what we're going through now have more, it makes it more believable because, like we may have said in early programs, I don't know that I've ever read a book other than the Bible. I did my best to read through the Bible, but... reading is just not my thing. A quick story. I was raised in the state of Maryland. I told you that I actually had truant officers in those days, and they would chase me and try to take me to reform school or take me back to school. So I'm in the fourth grade, and I'm sitting in the class with my friends, and then a lady walks in, and she had a clipboard, and she said, "Excuse me, class, is there a Doug Lockhart in here?" And I said, "Yes, ma'am, that's me right here." She says, "Come with me, young man. You're going to a special class." Well, hot damn, boy, I shoved my chair up under the desk, and I talked to my mates, and I said, "Listen, if I'm late coming out to the playground, probably because I'm being fitted up for a spacesuit or something, because this lady right here, she's finally recognized my potential. So I'll catch you all later by the swing set." Gotcha. Well, she took me down the hallway, and we turned in, went into this one room, and she said, "You can have that chair right over there, that desk." And I went in there and sat, and as I was walking back to my desk, there was a fellow over here on my left. And he was mostly naked. He was sitting in a chair. He had a football helmet on, and he was drooling, and he was moaning. And then there was another fella sitting beside him, and he apparently pooped himself, and there was pee on the floor, and there was nobody helping him. Like, there was nobody, no teacher helping him. He's just sitting there. Mm-hmm. And I sat down, and I thought, well, my goodness, I thought I just had Fruit Loops for breakfast, but they must have been laced with something, because I got stupid over in a few minutes, you know? So for the next 2 weeks, I sat and I learned my alphabets all over, and I learned my letters and colors. And it really did mess me up for a little bit. 2 weeks later, another lady walks in, a different one. She had a clipboard. And she says, "Excuse me, is there a Doug Lockhart in here?" Well, she knew darn well I was the only one that could speak in the class, so I raised my hand. I said, "Yes, ma'am. This is him right here. Doug, come on, let me help you straighten your helmet and your chair. This lady's taking you to a special class." I said, "I ain't falling for that again. You're not taking me no place specialer. You're taking me to the oven. Because there's no, this, you can't get specialer than where I am." So I was ready to bolt for the door, and she calmed me down. And she was actually doing a college thesis program back in the 70s, trying to figure out that some people's got different ways of learning. Some people learn by listening. Some people learn by watching or touching or reading. And I found that my unique way of learning was by watching your hands. And if you talked, you just confused me or made it worse. Huh. For some reason, if I read anything, there's a wire not hooked up in my between my eyes and my brain that makes any sense. I can't understand what I just read. So somebody will walk into my shop and, you know, we'll be having a deep discussion. They'll say, "Hey, you ever read that book by so-and-so?" And I'd laugh and I'd say, "Does it have pictures? Because if it doesn't have pictures, probably chances aren't no good. I haven't read that. Yeah. So I found out that that's the way I learn. And I also have a photographic memory, so I can recall really fast. But what happened was this lady put me in the arts program, and I became... Are you there?
Yes. I'm right here.
Yeah. Oh, something. So when she put me in the arts program, I stopped running from the truant officers. And I actually ended up in my final high school year on the honor roll. I was a model student, but you had to keep me away from these other classes, from math and science and history. I had no desire for history if it's not American history. Early American history, if you want to know some obscure knowledge, call me, because I've got it. I know hairstyles and clothing styles and songs and trends and traditions. Mm-hmm. And I just happen, I'm just, America is, history is my thing.
All right, so you're going to sing "I Dream of Jeannie" with the light brown hair? All right.
When you take all of that and you put it together and you look at what's happening here, this is absolutely mind-blowing. And I think I mentioned to you earlier, if my grade school or high school teachers, you know, got wind that I was compiling a book or writing or those, they would absolutely have a fit or heart attack, because this is just not the way I spend my leisure time. It's just not something I've ever longed to do. And that's what makes it more credible. I told you one time that, and this is just my opinion, that I can't stand poetry. It's just, even though I'm an artist, I don't like poetry because it's a way that nobody talks. It seems like you have to, and this is just my opinion, please don't be offended if it's not yours, but it seems too much effort for what you're trying to say. I don't know. I just don't get poetry. But in the course of writing these things, my wife's looking at me and here's four or five poems that were written, knowing full well that is just against my grain. So we've got a couple here. I think Bertie might read one of them. But I think I wanted to lead off with a story that happened. We were, it was 2011 in October.
You told them about it in the last show.
Yeah, if there's any overlap, don't hesitate to step up and say we've covered that. So let's keep.
Bertie and I are.
You covered the story about the two-star general, and Doug wanted to read the story. You already told him the whole story.
Oh, right,
the last
right.
One.
Okay.
Yeah, he just wanted to read the story.
The text is up there now.
Yeah, so he's got the text up for people to read it.
So Bertie and I are in the kitchen, and we're preparing our flags for the next day, and in comes this spirit form person, and he's leaning against our kitchen stove behind Bertie. She said she always feels them. And she said, Doug, somebody is standing right behind me. Would you look? And it was very late. It was 11 o'clock at night, I think. And I looked, and sure enough, here is a man in a military uniform. And the timeline, I could tell it was a Civil War, but he didn't have a hat on. It was interesting. And he's leaning against the stove. And she says, well, talk to him. What does he want? And then, so I got a piece of paper, and I got the pen, and I started to write. And this is what he said. I just started writing. I got a blank paper, and it said, he says, there are but only a few times during the course of a man's life that an occasion of such honor prevails over all other such events. Each time I am able to bear witness to these events brings my spirit to a bent knee of the greatest of respect. As I lay witness to the undaunting and tireless pursuit of this respectful act, I find myself again in the position of gratefulness. For it is of the greatest honor that these men receive, if nothing more than the acknowledgement of their service to thy neighbor and their flag. I, as do others, stand watch over these men, our men, as one by one are presented with the honor of their country and the respect of their family and neighbors.
Very good.
For it is these moments that are not easily forgotten, as these mm-hmm. memories are kept not within one's memory, but rather within their hearts. Your pursuit is recognized, appreciated, and welcomed, as I, on my bent knee, salute your selfless act upon those you share no acquaintance. We thank you and will remain upon this post until the last of our boys are known. Respectfully, General Longstreet, U.S. Army of the North. And that's
he
all
was late. That's the General Longstreet? He's a big name, isn't he?
Well, apparently we looked him up, and sure enough, it was General Longstreet. He had a red sash, had another insignia.
We have, let me find Bertie, look at the images. Which one is the transcription of what Doug just read? Where is it?
Okay, so if you go to the ones I sent you, it's the one that is two pages. So it's when you put it up, is a very first
one. It shows two full pages.
After the cover of the book. It's two pages.
We are grateful to the Almighty. Okay, is that where it starts?
Mm-hmm. That's correct. So those two pages, the after the cover book of the book, the first mm-hmm. and the second and third pages that you put up, are the letter from Longstreet. And, you know, I told Doug, I said, you remember exactly what he looks like. You can see him right now. So he's going to he should sketch him and, you know, see what he remembers, how he saw him. But because we only looked him up in the on the internet by name, but
got it. Well, no, he's I know that name from Civil War studies long ago. General Longstreet. Okay, it's the first image is the image of the graveyard with the American flag on the right, and that tombstone is actually potentially the tombstone of Doug when he was incarnated in those times, and he died there, and they gave him a number, and that's his monument. Now the second and third images are what Doug just read. Okay, now let me point out that is cursive writing. Now, you're not a cursive writer.
Right. I think he's talking about the cursive writing is the fourth page, the one that says, I am Mary. Is that what you're referring to? Because when he started writing on March 21st of 2009, he started writing.
Yeah. That's the cursive one. I beg your pardon.
That's the cursive one. I didn't
number
put
four.
The whole story on there, but I can put the whole story and just number the pages.
That's okay.
For you.
It's a fourth image over altogether. One, two, three,
yeah.
Four. Starts
so
out with I am Mary.
The fourth image where it starts with I am Mary, that's where he started writing, and Doug does not write cursive. He can barely write his name Doug.
If it's an overlap again, I was only exposed to it maybe one day in grade school, and then we were never meant. Or
I got you.
Do that again.
All right, let's describe this. This is often called automatic writing.
Right.
But did Mary say, "I have something to deliver to you now, and I'd like you to write it down"? How did this writing happen? What were you doing,
okay.
And how did she let you know? Go ahead.
Okay, the interesting part is Doug would go to work, and then he would come home, take a shower, eat dinner. Then we would sit in like a comfortable lounging chair, light a candle to say we're ready. He'd have his notebook, and then I would wait till I felt Ted's group because I felt them on my right side. My entire body just tingled with energy, and I would say they are all here and they're ready. And then he would say okay, and then Doug would look and he can see. Well, Doug, you can describe better what you could see, and that's how it would begin every night.
I would see in my mind's eye, I would see a wall, and there's like a shower curtain above this little 3-foot wall, and there's a split in the curtain, and you could see forms on the other side of this hazy shower curtain. But whenever somebody would pass the slit, then you could see real details, whether it was male or female.
But you also saw a circle.
There's a circle on the other side of that veil.
And he could see their feet around the circle. The circle, you said you saw their feet, and you would know if it was a male or female child.
They would step into a light. There was a bright light in the middle of the circle, and whoever wanted to speak would step from that circle, from the like haze into the circle, and I could then tell it was a child or a man or a woman or black or white. And so between us sitting sideways was a man sitting in a chair at that wall, at that slit, and they would speak, and he would begin to speak and tell me, and then all I do is write it down. So this is interesting, is Mary is in this book, because in this book, a lot of these people are from the 1800s. And Mary's here is from 1970s, which is very, late in the program here. But her story was amazing. She gave me this story, and this is a famous local folklore story, about at this time in the 70s, the men and women, so if you look at the asylum, you have the administration or the admittance area in the middle, which is the great big towers, and on the left was the left of that was the men's wing, 4 floors, and on the right was the women's wing, 4 floors. Well, back in the 70s, they started to drop and decrease in patients, so they said, okay, we're going to shut down the women's wing, move the men and the women together, like the men were on the top 2 floors and the women were on the bottom 2 floors, something like that. So if Mary then wandered off one day, and the local story says. She wandered off one day, and they couldn't find her. And then, I don't know, a good while longer, like a week later, they finally found her. No, it's got to be longer than a week. It was a long time. I'd have to look that up exactly. Well, they found her, and she was in an abandoned part of the women's wing, very obscure, and she was laying and froze to death on a cement floor, completely nude. Well, in the process of her decaying and dying, her body fluids etched her silhouette into the floor.
Huh.
So there's many photographs online, and you can still see this. So we had part of this writing. We had to go see this, and that's another whole incredible story how doors were allowed, because this is a closed-off, asbestos-filled, pigeon manure kind of abandoned place that nobody wants you to go. So it's restricted. But we were able to get access to it, and so we could go for ourselves. Well, in the process of going from the administration area to where we found this stain, a person would have to have an equivalent of 20 to 25 keys. Because the amazing thing was, one key was not a master key to open up all these doors. There was many keys to open these doors. Mm-hmm. So that means that this woman, as a patient, had to have that ring and know the key sequence to get there, and nobody knows how she got it. So it doesn't make sense how this all happened.
No.
All right, so there's a controversy about what happened or was said to have happened and really happened. Mm-hmm. So she comes to me and she starts giving me these details, and they're quite a bit different than what the news report has said.
What are you doing? Excuse me, Doug. What are you doing when she came to you? Are you sitting with Birdie and you're mentally open to this?
Yeah. And I was sitting with a candle, and she was the one that stepped into the light and told us this story. Now,
I'm watching him, incredibly watching him, going, wow, he cannot write like this. And it was, you know, this looks like, to me, a female handwriting from the past.
So here's where it goes crazy sideways. I wrote this story, and I had it written for about 4 days, maybe. And then I was just compiling the story like I do with all of them. And I'm in my blacksmith shop, and a lady walks in, and I'd never met her before, and she says, I would like to commission you to make a bronze rose for my husband's headstone that passed away a couple years ago. I said, okay. So I always do this. I don't like to speak in third person. I like to, if I'm talking about somebody deceased, I like to address them by their name. So I asked, what was your husband's name? And she told me. And I said, well, what did he do for vocation? She said, this is 4 days after I wrote this, and my blacksmith shop is about 35 miles from the asylum. And she said, he was the head maintenance man at the Athens Lunatic Asylum.
Which is what it was called.
And I said,
correct.
What? She says, yeah. And so I said, can I talk to you a minute? And I pulled her aside. And I told her what was happening. I just took a stab, because this is just too crazy that this would be happening. Not too much of a coincidence. And she said, the way I met him is I was the head nurse down there. I said, oh my gosh, you got to hear what I'm getting ready to tell you. So I told her this story. And she told me, when this incident happened, there was the administrator of the hospital, this woman who was the head nurse, and her husband who had the ring of keys that found her. Those three people. And she said, I'm here to tell you that what you just told me was the truth, and it's not what's written in the papers. There's a cover-up, and you can read it in the book. Talks about the whole thing. And Mary was very plain. You know, she says, I don't have to get into great detail, but just think about this. It's late in the year. It's February. And I go to a part of the hospital that has no heat. I take off all my clothes and fold them up. I lay down on a cement slab, and I lay just straight out and die. She said, do you realize that even if I was crazy and going to die, my body would override and turn me into a fetal position, so I would not have left a stain in the shape that is there. And she said, nobody looked at my neck where I was bruised. So there was a great controversy. And again, it was not to get anybody in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
But
naming names
or anything, but just to get the story out there and the truth out there. And mm-hmm. again, I'm a decorative iron worker, and I'm not big on all of that goings on. And here I have all of this detailed information. We were then put in touch with her, Mary's social worker. Mm-hmm. We ended up having a meeting in town. And he was very nervous.
The deceased Mary's social worker is still around.
Correct.
Right.
And we read this story to him, mm-hmm. and he got so emotional. And he had to leave early because he couldn't. He was very emotional about it. And he said that he knew that this was happening.
He was very good friends with her. He thought she was a wonderful person.
Yeah. He said he knew all along this is what happened, and he knew the people involved. But...
wow.
The story came out different. So that was another one of those amazing coincidences, or, you know, that the workings of Ted's group on one end and the physical on this end to help put this story together, to get the word out that these people, you know, circumstances put them here. Not everybody was crazy or, you know, psychotic, but there was just life circumstances
right.
that they
sure.
ended up here.
It's just too much for people, and they need a break. They need help. I get
it. Yeah, right. But that didn't make it okay to bury you in an unmarked grave.
No.
No, to lose your respect.
So Mary came to you, and without going through the whole thing you wrote, what is she asking for? Is she asking you for help? What does she want?
She asked that her story would be included in this book, and that this book was to be used for a couple of reasons. One, it was to show that people were real people,
mm-hmm.
and that the hospital is not everything that it was, you know, even though it was started with good intentions, there was a lot that went on behind the scene. But that she was really open that the proceeds, you know, I think the big story was that the proceeds from this book were going to help to gain awareness. And not only to Athens or to the state of Ohio, but to other facilities, whether they're old folks' home, nursing homes, orphanages.
Oh, there's so much negligence in all of these care facilities now. It's terrible. Wait, she died in 1970. When did the hospital shut down?
It shut down in 93.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. And she was her story is in 73.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but she didn't. She just wanted her real story, the real story, the truth to be told, because her story is one of the stories that's all over the internet. If you look up,
right,
her name is there, calling her Margaret Schilling. So if your viewers want to look up Margaret Schilling at the Athens Lunatic Asylum, which is now called the Ridges, RIDGES, that's the new name. It has gone through several names.
And we didn't understand, too, because local, everything that we know is she's known as Margaret. And she says, mm-hmm. yeah, they called me Margaret, but my name was Mary, or I went by Mary. Mm-hmm. And when we told that to her social worker, he said, oh, my gosh, you know, yeah. there was just a few people that called her Mary. So he was blown away by that, too.
Yeah.
So he believed that she was... at that moment, in contact with you, giving you and helping you write her message to you.
When
Doug, hold on. When you're writing these things down, do you feel like you're consciously moving your hand? How does it feel when these people are writing through you?
I can't. That's a very great question, because I do it. I do not get tired. So a lot of times I think I feel as if I fall asleep. And because this is interesting, I kind of go into some sort of a trance, and I don't really feel like the spirit is grabbing my hand. And even though there are some unique peculiarities, like, for instance, Mary writing in cursive, I can't answer that question because Doug doesn't know how to write in cursive. I don't really feel that she, like, put her arm inside of my arm and did that, but I'm not really sure how that all comes together. When Dr. Samuel Wallace wrote his name, he jumped in and the energy increased in these moments. But most of the time, this is interesting. I will write the whole story and then Bertie will read it back, because as fast as I write, it's difficult for me to read my own handwriting, and I have no clue of what I just wrote.
He doesn't remember. He doesn't recall anything.
And if you look at the writings, Bertie sent you all these different samples. Mm-hmm. What's interesting to me is I don't see anything scribbled out, like a word that was, we should put another word in there instead of this one. It was just an incredible download of
constant
thought, visual, and recording that all was blasted at one time. Mm-hmm. There's another time that happens when I will channel my guide, my spiritual guide that helps me through this physical world. And in order to do that, I actually do this. And if you can follow me in your imagination, if you're looking in your room right now, look out. Your left eyeball is looking out the left eye hole socket, and your right is doing that out the right, so that your vision is straight. Well, for me, in order to channel, I actually move over, and my right eyeball looks out my left eye socket. And so what I do is I freely give my body to my guide, but not completely, because I'm uncomfortable with that. So this is like an agreement. Okay, I'll have half, and if I don't like what's going on, I'm going to jump back in and push you out. But I actually, Bertie will ask a ton of questions. We've ended up, it's so much that we've gone audio instead of writing everything. I had to use my right eyeball so I could see the paper to write or whatever. But now I actually kind of like go to sleep.
Yep, he does.
The physical Doug's brain goes to sleep, and I open a channel for my vocal cords that she can communicate and go back and forth. So when I'm doing this writing, it's very similar, because I feel like I go to sleep because I have no memory. But there was a
are you
time
looking?
When she sat,
are you still looking at the paper with your right eye, out of the left eye socket?
No. Because I was thinking about that. When I'm writing, I physically have control of both eyeballs.
Okay.
I'm aware of that, so I didn't really move over that far, I guess, in my body. But Bertie was sitting beside me, and I was writing, and the most I did, the only time I stopped was to turn the page of the paper, and we did 35 pages in one sitting, and it's just as fast as I could form a letter.
Yeah, he writes very fast, very fast, especially
all
when Ted writes.
From Mary? Is this all Mary?
This was somebody else speaking, and I don't even know that it had anything to do with the book, but you know, they give us so much information because we had so many questions.
Sure.
You know, like they answer us in order of importance. That's what they told us. But especially when Ted writes, when he speaks, Doug writes so fast. He tells him, "Slow down. You're going too fast." You know, he speaks fast, and so Doug writes really fast. It's incredible to watch him. It's like his hand moves so fast I can barely keep up with turning the page for him.
And I have OCD tendencies, and I'm becoming more and more aware of them. And this fella Ted, there's just no way I could write on a piece of paper and not stay in the lines. This dude will write on two lines. He'll write
three lines. Yeah.
He'll write sideways.
Yeah.
It's just super crazy. And then we asked him about that, and he goes, "Sorry, I'm just not used to having lines on my paper. I don't know when they started putting lines on paper, but he said he's not used to that."
But maybe you know, some of the people that are listening can look at the writing that I sent on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the fifth page that I sent you a picture of, where it starts, "Please do not speak, go, feel and listen your mind." That was the last part of some of the writing that Doug's...
was writing earlier.
That Adam was writing. Now, he just wrote love, but on the previous pages, he started, this is Adam. And so the bottom part of the first page on the left side is me taking notes saying, you know, Ted wrote five pages, and then Adam started speaking, and then on the right side, Ted started speaking after Adam, and look at the difference of the handwriting, and that was right after he finished writing Adam, and then he went to the next page and kept going, and I knew it was Ted because the writing switched to Ted's handwriting. I'm like, oh, now Ted's speaking, because every time he wrote, I'm always right next to him. Because they tell us if we sit together, our light is brighter, and they can see us, and they know we're ready.
Let me jump back. Hold on. Just do a search for Margaret, M-A-R-G-A-R-E-T, Margaret Schilling, S-C-H-I-L-L-I-N-G, at Athens Lunatic Asylum, or just probably at Athens Asylum will work.
Just look up Margaret Schilling Stain, and you'll find it.
There you go, Margaret Schilling Stain. That is really eerie. Now, that stain appears to me to be her back.
Yeah, she's laying
on her face. She died face down, face up?
No, face up, because her body fluids did that stain on the floor, but... you can see her buttocks. You can see the shape. You can see she had no clothing, and she's laying on a cement floor. We actually went and saw this stain.
That's face up, Doug.
Correct.
That stain.
She was killed. Yeah, she was definitely murdered.
And mm-hmm. she had her arms crossed on her chest, with her, and she was straight, laid flat, straight.
That looks to me like she's laying face down. That's what I see. I see the back of her head. I see her shoulder. I see her back. I see her rib.
Yeah.
Well, that's only because you're looking at the reverse image of her.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
See, that's what it's a negative.
Yeah. So.
Well, that's really
very
strange.
But we actually went and looked at it, and it's still there.
That door is still there. We were still standing next to that door. But this is in a very, very remote very hard to get to place, and
I gotcha.
You'll read the story in there.
I'm looking at that Gothic building. Is talk about a perfect movie set, a movie studio would jump all over that. They probably have.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Absolutely.
That's a real creepy thing. It's a big complex too. There's an aerial view of it. It's building after building.
Well, it was in its time. Jeff, in 1880s, it was the largest employer of Ohio at the time. It was a huge farm.
Self-sustained.
Their dairy cattle. They had world-class dairy cattle where people came to buy bulls from them. So it was their intentions and...
Whoops, we lost him. We'll get him back. This Margaret Schilling thing, Margaret Schilling stain, that probably will do it. It's reminds me of the Shroud of Turin a little bit somehow, although this was chemically etched into the concrete, but it's that kind of an image. Very, very strange, and that whole facility looks awfully creepy.
Okay.
There's some photographs of doctors working on patients, and it looks like they're doing lobotomies on them.
Oh, yeah,
something
lots
really,
of lobotomies.
Really bad. Oh, bad stuff.
Yeah,
bad
lots
stuff.
Of lobotomies went on. Lots and lots of lobotomies. A lot of, and they did the cold water baths too, like where they would put them in the bathtub, tie them down, and they would fill up the bathtub with water and ice, and tie the patients to the.
This is not what you'd call therapeutic. There's a photograph here, allegedly, of Margaret Schilling with long black hair. I don't think that's, I don't know what that is. She didn't have any gray. She's nothing. She looks awful.
Yeah.
Awful. Anyway, whatever.
I don't know.
It's a big story.
If you, Dr. Samuel Wallace, addresses some of what you just talked about. He was a doctor pre-Civil War. He was studying medicine, and he talks about his struggles in our book. And the struggles are when as a physical physician, let's just talk about a bullet wound. You can tell where the bullet went in and where the bullet went out, and how you can address that. But when you're talking about mental illness, and here they are in the 1870s, you can't see an entrance wound or an exit wound. You just see the results of the injury. And so they didn't know where to begin to treat or where to end.
Yeah.
And he talks about the complex struggle that he struggled with, and it's very well written.
Oh, yeah. Okay. We have about five minutes max. So you want to get to Dr. Schilling? That's the one on the far right, the image.
I think that Doug was just looking at the one you have up on the far right. That's Dr. Samuel D. Wallace. That's the one that Doug was just talking about.
I said Dr. Schilling. I meant Wallace.
Yeah, Dr. Samuel D. Wallace. The reason I put that up is because I thought, okay, this was the last page, and look at his doctor's signature that,
That looks nuts to me, signature.
I know.
We were trying to find that in history, but we haven't yet.
We haven't really found them, but maybe somebody would like to research Dr. Samuel D. Wallace to see if that signature would match his signature. That would be interesting.
Was he supposedly a staff doctor at that lunatic asylum?
He was.
He was, but he was a doctor in the Civil War.
Yeah.
That ended up at the asylum. That's when he's talking about his conflict.
He is chapter 18 in the book. He tells his story from a doctor.
That's your writing. That's your printing of what he's telling you.
That's the printing when he was telling his story, and that's the last two pages of his story. But I sent you a picture of that so that everyone could see his signature. At the very end, he signed his name, and I thought, well, isn't that interesting? But I wanted to end maybe with this note. A lot of this, what I consider sort of poems that Doug wrote, which he would never do if he wasn't channeling, is one that all of them are really very heart-wrenching, but this one, it's only like a short one. May I read that tonight and maybe end
with
that?
Go ahead. Yes, we have a couple minutes. Go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. So they titled it "When," and it's an unknown.
Doug wrote this.
Doug wrote this, channeled it, and it was somebody that was part of Ted's group, but they would not give their name, and that they just wrote
somebody,
on the top.
All right.
They just wrote "when" with a question mark. When is it okay to say I've had enough? When is it time to be removed from society for behaving in a different manner? When is it okay to be treated with disrespect, dishonor, and in an undignified manner? When is it time to be alone? When is it right to repeat the things you hear, even though nobody else hears them? When is it time to stop caring? When is it okay to cry? And when will you know it's time to die? When is it right to be forgotten and be buried without your name? When is it okay to be forgotten? When?
Wow, and unidentified person on the other side gave that to you. No, we don't know who.
No, they would not give their name. They just said unknown.
That is very moving. You're right. I agree.
Some of the other ones I can't even finish reading. They're just, really sad. They really get to you.
Well, there's a lot of people that went through that facility who died there who are still there. And we mentioned last time, some are hanging around until they get properly recognized. And to them, potentially time means nothing now. I wouldn't think it would, but they're not moving on like they should have.
They're not. And they're doing it for everyone, not just themselves. They're doing it for the truth. Yeah. They're doing it for people to correct the wrong that was done wrong in the past.
Got it.
Yeah.
Well, all right. Very good. Well, fascinating material as always. So keep it up, and we'll talk again. Let's see what comes up next. Thank you both.
Thank you so
very much.
All right, Jeff.
Good night, everyone.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
All right, Birdie. Okay, Doug. Glad you're both feeling better. Keep it up. All right. We will be back tomorrow, Friday, end of another week. And we're watching the Israeli war on Iran, which started now, well, 5 hours ago, something like that. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 4 hours ago. So it's underway right now. All right. You wonder who's, by the way, who's refueling a lot of those Israeli jets. Who has air tanker capability? Want to guess? All right. Back tomorrow. Take care.